The Guardian.
The two great projects of Peter Mandelson's life have been Britain in Europe and Labour in power. And in the last few years, both those dreams have been shattered. I'm Jonathan Friedland, and throughout August, I'll be speaking to some of the UK's most prominent political movers and shakers. This week, I'm talking to the former Labour Cabinet Minister and EU Commissioner, Peter Mandelson. He's now the president of the international think tank Policy Network. I began by asking Lord Mandelson about the World Trade Organization. Boris Johnson's government chose in the end to nominate Liam Fox as Director General of the World Trade Organization. There had been talk of you as being perhaps even more ideal candidate for that job, considering you did trade as a commissioner for the European Union. I mean, there was, always a lost cause, the idea that a Conservative government would nominate Peter Mandelson as its nomination for the WTO.
Small chance, but not non-existent. I mean, I was actually at the beginning encouraged by members of the government to throw my hat in the ring for this. I won't embarrass them by naming them. But they did think that it would be a good idea, you know, if global Britain means anything at all, that this is the sort of international post that a British government should nominate somebody for. I had obvious credentials, which they acknowledged. I don't think I emerged from my time as Europe's Trade Commissioner, you know, with a bad reputation. And they encouraged me. But, you know, in the end, number 10 took a view, and this was conveyed to me very directly, that my overall position on Brexit disqualified me. They were actually going to not to nominate anyone at all. It was only at the last minute that they nominated Liam, I think under quite considerable pressure from the US government. I mean, I would always have been a long shot, but nonetheless, I had a shot. I'm not sure you could say that about Liam.
When you say this was told to you directly, I mean, did you ever have a conversation with Boris Johnson, with Rishi Sunak, with the Foreign Secretary, with anyone at that kind of level about you doing this?
Not with those individuals. And if you don't mind, I'm not going to go into the history of it. But you know, I made the case that, in my view, the WTO's rulebook certainly needs updating for the 21st century, you know, to cater for the differences in state-dominated economies and those in the West. And I feel quite strongly that we need a reformed international system which manages and integrates the rise of China rather than seeks to exclude China. So I had quite a sort of prospectus, and I did discuss it with people. But in the end, as I said, they decided that a non-Brexiter was not possible.
And you mentioned that you were always a long shot. How would you estimate the chances of Liam Fox?
Well, you know, the way in which the job is selected is by consensus and consultation. And that means that the biggest players in the WTO, United States, European Union, China, Brazil, India, and one or two others, they do have the biggest say. They, in effect, have a veto. And with the best will in the world, I don't think Liam Fox is going to be acceptable, certainly not to the European Union. I mean, it would be difficult for the European Union to accept any Brit for the job, but they would have had more difficulty rejecting me, having been a former European Trade Commissioner. I mean, he is fairly strongly aligned with the American point of view on trade and the WTO. That's a fairly minority position within the WTO. So I don't really see it taking off, but I wish him luck, and I'm sure he'll throw his all into it.
You're one of the very few people who can see from both angles, both sides, the current negotiation between Britain and the EU, because, you know, you were a first secretary, the most senior cabinet minister in a British government, and you were, as you've been saying, the trade commissioner for the European Union. As you watch these talks now about a future trade agreement between Britain and the European Union, how confident are you that despite all the smoke signals, there could be a deal? Or are you coming to the view that Britain is going to leave on December 31st with no deal?
Well, at the heart of the negotiation is a very tricky tension between the UK that wants to exercise complete sovereignty over its economy and trade and its rules and its standards, on the one hand, and on the other, the European Union, which is saying, if you want, you know, this large economy sitting on our border and you want sort of access to our single market from which you've just left, you know, we've got to exercise some measure of control over how you trade, your rules and your standards. And that is a very difficult thing to navigate. I think it is possible to do. Indeed, I think it's absolutely essential, because I think that for Britain to leave the European Union and to sever all our privileged trade rights with that huge market, which is in effect our own home market in Europe, would have extremely serious consequences for our economy and for jobs and livelihoods in this country. It's so extreme in a sense that I can hardly believe the government would contemplate it, especially on top of, you know, the chaos and economic business destruction that I'm afraid that COVID is going to wreak on the country. I mean, it would be a fearsome double whammy, which I would have thought that most rational governments would not want to contemplate.
What you've done there, though, is describe the case against leaving with no deal, which obviously people would expect to hear from you and would be very, find, I'm sure, very persuasive. What you haven't said is whether you think that is where we're heading.
Look, my hunch, my instinct is that we will have to strike a deal, and that Boris Johnson will do in this case what he did over the withdrawal agreement, say no, 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 until the last minute, at which point he said yes and embraced Theresa May's deal to all intents and purposes. He says he negotiated a wonderful deal. Well, all he did was to take the one that was on offer, claim it as his own, and describe it as a great triumph. Now, I do think it will be more difficult to do that in the case of a trade agreement, but not impossible. And I think that's where we will end up. But honestly, I don't know better than anyone else. I guess the government is capable of doing anything, really, or ending up in any position. So I can't predict what will happen. I just feel instinctively and rationally that that's what we've got to do.
I mean, in the case you mentioned, the concession that Boris Johnson was prepared to make in order to get that deal, we knew what that was. It was to allow the crossing of this red line and allow a border down the Irish Sea. He previously said that he wouldn't countenance that, and then he did. What do you imagine is the big concession Boris Johnson, the UK government, could make now to get that deal?
I think it has to do with what they call the level playing field, the playing field of standards, legal rights, entitlements, the way in which we operate our state aids, you know, how government pours money into the economy on labour, social, environmental standards and rules. I think what he will do, or what I believe he should do, I guess, is say, look, we're not going to step back from or resile from those standards that we already operate, which are Europe standards. But we don't want to be subject to every single last sort of change, refinement, further turning of the kaleidoscope in relation to those standards in future. I mean, we can't literally be a regulatory satellite of the European Union, but nor are we going to seek to undercut the European Union in the standards we operate. And therefore, we're going to accept what we have at the moment and what we do and what we operate and not fall below them in the future.
This is this territory of sort of dynamic alignment and all of that, that we have alignment, but maybe not quite in perfect lockstep.
Look, to be honest, I think that the European Union set rather or too high a bar in its negotiation on level playing field. And I think to say that there has to be, as you call it, dynamic alignment, i.e. every single future change or new rule or standard or refinement that the European Union introduces in the future, Britain must comply with. I think that's too tough. We're not actually members of the European Union. But I do nonetheless think that, as we've said before, as was reflected in the agreement, the political declaration that we struck with the European Union, you know, we don't want to undercut. We don't want to, you know, start embarking on a course where we're going to create some competitive advantage for ourselves against the European Union by lowering these standards and rules and changing our legislation, which we've introduced and operated in the past.
Now, we've talked a lot about Europe, but I think it would be fair to say, we'll see if I'm right, the cause of your life has been Labour and the Labour Party and getting Labour into power. How far do you think Labour is from power now?
Well, you're right. I have worked for three leaders directly in my life since the 1980s, Kinnock, then Blair, then Brown. All were different in their backgrounds and their outlooks, but each had at the core of their being a desire to make Labour electorally competitive and in with a really good chance of winning an election. Now, I believe that in contrast to his predecessors, immediate predecessors, Keir Starmer has this inner core determination. I think there's no doubt at all about that. And this has to be his first priority. But he does have to outline a project beyond taking back control of the party from the factionalists and the anti-Semites who we associate with the Corbyn era. But it's going to be a far harder task, frankly, than Blair had before 1997. I have no illusions about that. I mean, the whole economic challenge in itself is far, far more complex, you know, with a combination of COVID and Brexit to handle.
But hang on, those things could actually make it easier, couldn't they? Not to govern, but to get power, because they could make the current government so much more unpopular.
Yes, it is possible, and I want to come on, I think, and describe the sort of progressive project that Keir could build out of COVID. But I just make this sort of basic observation to you. I mean, not only is the state of the economy different from what it was in 1997, but there is an even bigger difference in the state of the party. You know, Keir is not building on what has gone before in the way that Tony did following a decade of the Labour Party changing and moving forward, you know, beginning with Kinnock in the 1980s. Instead, Keir has taken over after a decade of the party not moving forwards, but actually going backwards. So in effect, the task is to pack the scale of change that Labour went through between 1983 and 1997 into one term. I mean, Starmer has, in effect, to be both Kinnock and Blair rolled into one. And that's a heck of a challenge for anyone to take on. I'm not saying, incidentally, before you jump in, that he has to be a replica of either Kinnock or Blair. I'm not saying that his project has to be the same as New Labour, or indeed to repeat New Labour's mistakes. He has to construct a project of his own, and it has to come across as more than a short-term political fix, somebody who simply wants to bury the last dark decade of Labour's history, become the grown-up in the room with strong values and a good character, which undoubtedly he has, who you can see representing Britain on the world stage, but is otherwise unclear about his political vision and what a vote for Labour means. You know, those last things have to fall into place and be at the heart of an effective, credible political project of his own.
Are you saying that at the moment you do think he's unclear about the vision and the future and the programme he would implement as Prime Minister?
Well, he's only just got there, so it's early days.
No, I don't mean that necessarily it's a criticism, but are you just saying as a description, as a statement of fact, that is at the moment the gap?
It is a gap, which I'm sure he recognises and intends to fill, but he's had two very big things on his hands. One is COVID, and secondly, having to deal with the party and to, in effect, to take the party back from those who controlled it and what it was under Jeremy Corbyn. And he's made a very, very good start in that. I mean, he's certainly put Labour back onto the electoral pitch. He's put us back into contention. But we are a long way from winning the next election. That's clear.
We're going to take a quick break, after which we'll hear more about Peter Mandelson's vision for the Labour Party under Keir Starmer. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Politics Weekly. I'm Jonathan Friedland. This week, I'm speaking with Peter Mandelson. And I'm very interested, because you did work directly with Kinnock, with Blair and with Brown, do you see in Keir Starmer the same drive to power that I think you would say characterised, well, certainly two of those three, and therefore equips him to make it?
I like all three things about Keir Starmer. I like his values. I share them. I think he has a good, solid character, which the public can see. He is determined for Labour to win the next election. And he's prepared to do what it takes to achieve that. So he starts from an incredibly good base. And I actually think that coming out of COVID, he does actually have a good opportunity to build a new progressive project. I mean, he himself has emphasized that, you know, during this sort of pandemic, our society has come to recognize the value of those who do, you know, who do essential jobs for little monetary reward. And we've got to rectify that. You know, we can't tolerate that. I also agree that the reason why Britain has had one of the worst records in coping with COVID in Europe has been the impact of a decade of austerity. I mean, Public Health England was, for example, was cut to shreds. And look at the shameful neglect of social care. So I think that what we've got to do coming out of COVID is to recall and recommit to that powerful post-war 1945 spirit of never again. And that, I think, has to be his clarion call and his vision. And then he's got to put in place a program and policies to support that.
You mentioned that, you know, his primary task, and you feel he's made progress on that, was to get the party, your words, out of the grip of the factionalists and the anti-Semites. There will be some people listening to this who think factionalists, well, you're a factionalist, Peter Mandelson. You're just from a different faction. That it's the Blairite or New Labour faction. What would you say to that?
I would say that we did not operate in a political bubble. You know, we created and constructed a political project as modern social democrats who wanted to take the best of laborism and the best of liberalism and apply a whole new set of ideas to running the country for the 21st century, just as the Tories had done rather too successfully for most of the 20th, and that the party, its membership and our supporters in the country admired that and they wanted to be part of it. I mean, we did embrace very basic progressive and labour values and principles. That was at the heart of our programme and what we were about. But we also knew that the country urgently needed healing and modernising in the 1990s. We needed to turn away from the sort of awful social illiberalism and the nostalgic nationalism of the Thatcher era. And we had to use the power of both government and business to enable our economy to compete with the best in Europe and in the rest of the world. I think we did have, in other words, a very big political project which people signed up to right across the party and across the country. I mean, that's, after all, why we won in 1997 the biggest majority in our party's history and why we won again with big majorities in 2001 and 2005.
I mean, you were a veteran of those huge battles that you just, I think, referred to about the soul of the Labour Party in the 1980s.
Yeah.
And I just want to put to you one, what I think is a difference. In 1983, when Neil Kinnock, who you worked with, took over, there wasn't a body of the membership who believed that Michael Foot was an almost saintly figure, heroic figure, who any deviation from Footism was a terrible betrayal, who couldn't get over his departure, who regarded with great suspicion anybody who dared say anything critical about his leadership. And yet, I think now that is the case for a body of opinion within Labour who feel tremendously emotionally attached to Jeremy Corbyn and Corbynism, and therefore we're already denouncing Keir Starmer for deviating from that. Does that not make Starmer's task much harder than the task you and Neil Kinnock and the others had in the 1980s in shifting Labour?
I simply don't agree with you. I mean, what is striking now is the disconnect between the sort of factional political bubble that Jeremy Corbyn inhabited and the tens, literally tens of thousands of party members who had voted for Corbyn originally and then ended up completely alienated from him and bewildered by what it was all about and where it had left us, a Tory government with a majority of over 80 seats. I mean, these are the same people who gave Keir Starmer, you know, his overwhelming victory. They did so because they were disillusioned by Corbyn, not because they believed in him and thought he was the Messiah.
So you wouldn't be swayed by the, or am I being too swayed by the unrepentant Corbynites on social media?
You said it.
Because they're very vocal, aren't they, Peter? I mean, they're very vocal, those people, and they, you can perhaps make the mistake of thinking they speak for a large section of the Labour Party. Are you saying that, no, they don't?
Look, I'm quite sure that there are people in the party, you know, who think that Jeremy's leadership was a great success for Labour and it was only that he was only robbed of ultimate victory by a combination of the right-wing media and treacherous Labour MPs intent on stopping a bad Brexit, and that if all these people had got out of the way, you know, Jeremy would have raced up the motorway and delivered a huge electoral success for Labour. I'm sure there are some who think like that, but, you know, I'm not on social media. I don't hear them, I don't listen to them, and they don't represent, in my view, the broad swathe of party members in the country or Labour voters across the United Kingdom.
One thing that you would hear if you were on social media, but I think you hear it actually even outside there, is the case that it's not fair, and this, you might hear this even from people who are very sort of Corbyn sceptic, it is not fair to put all of this on him, and that actually when you look at the red wall seats, in particularly in the North England, north of England, northeast, the alienation of the red wall actually began 15, 20 years earlier, even under Tony Blair, that there was a steady process of alienation of, you know, low-income, working-class, one-time Labour voters from today's Labour Party that goes back decades. And that, therefore, even New Labour, partly becoming more socially liberal and metropolitan and pro-European, partly New Labour is to blame for that long process of which 2019 was the culmination.
Well, I'm sure that there will be those who want and are able to blame New Labour for everything. But what the election results in 97, 2001, 2005, and to an extent in 2010 demonstrate is that we never lost connection with that sort of core base Labour vote. In contrast to, I mean, Corbynism, which totally lacked the empathy to connect with swathes, both of traditional Labour voters and swing voters concerned about the country's future. It was a double failure and, frankly, a damning indictment of Corbynism that more working class voters backed Johnson in December's election than they did Corbyn. I think that failure was rooted in, frankly, Jeremy's disdain for our country. That's how it came across. Disdain for our history and the aspirations of many, as well as a failure, frankly, to present a programme with realistic priorities, with realistic choices to address the urgent needs of the country. I mean, between one election in 2017 and the next in 2019, he doubled our spending promises and halved our credibility. I mean, what do you expect voters, both in, you know, red wall seats, as you call them, or in the Midlands or in the South, you know, to think? I mean, you know, frankly, they were, I think they were sort of bemused.
It obviously had its effect in December 2019. How lasting do you think the damage of that is? Does it outlast Corbyn himself?
Well, we have a lot to live down, frankly. But I do think Keir Starmer and his front bench are able to reconstruct a vision, a project that means more to people and with which people across the country can identify with. I mean, I think there are two things that have come out of COVID in a sense. One is a new communitarian spirit which wants to value every citizen. We've also seen in the economy the vital role that the state is playing during COVID in mitigating what you know, could have been and might still be a potential economic, you know, disaster. We used to talk about government intervention in this country as if it was exceptional, as well as almost certainly likely to go wrong. Now we're seeing government and business intertwined on a day-to-day basis. That partnership now, in my view, has to be extended in ways that enable key parts of our manufacturing and services sectors to benefit from large infusions of new technology, from machine learning, from data analytics and artificial intelligence. And government and business have got to work together on that. We are on the verge of a fresh industrial revolution. We've got to put that, to fold that into a program, a set of policies, which really does enable people to say, you know, never again. We're not going to go back to an unacceptable past.
I mentioned before labour as the great project of your life. I think Europe, we could say, is the other one, these two great causes. And yet here we are talking now in 2020, and Britain is leaving Europe, and the Labour Party will require the biggest ever swing, I think, to get a majority of just one seat at the next election. Does this, I wonder, fill you with something like despair, that this was, these are the two great causes of your life, and I wonder if on some level you feel as if you failed?
At a personal level, I feel miserable about it. I do feel, in a sense, defeated. I feel tremendously set back, both in respect of Labour's failure during the last decade and by our leaving the European Union. Do I, along with many others, take my fair share of responsibility for that? Of course I do. You know, no doubt we have made mistakes, but we have been overtaken by a convulsion in politics over the last decade and more, one that has seen a fragmentation, a fracturing of our politics and people's traditional allegiances and loyalties to parties for which they voted in the past. There is no more a sort of automaticity in people's voting allegiances and intentions. We have to recognize that, and it just means that we have to work all that much more harder to make sure that we renew our appeal, reinvent not what we stand for as a party, because that basic ideology of Labour, our values and purpose, are timeless and they are intact. But how we apply those values and that purpose to the 21st century, all this has got to be seriously rethought and revamped and delivered with confidence and with a professionalism that we had before, and which I'm afraid that we have lost during the last decade. But we can recover, and absolutely anything I can do to contribute to it, I will.
Peter Mandelson, thank you very much for talking to Politics Weekly.
Pleasure.
Next week, I talk to the Deputy First Minister of Northern Ireland, Sinn Féin's Michelle O'Neill, about what it's like to work with the DUP's Arlene Foster and the prospect of a united Ireland post-Brexit. But that's all from me this week. The producer is Danielle Stevens. I'm Jonathan Friedland. Please stay safe and thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.